Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Listening Behind the Curtain, our opportunity to step into the world of theater and the arts. And today, really interesting approach because, as you know, I'm a big Sondheim lover, and I'm guessing many of you are. You don't have to be for this particular show, but if you are a Sondheim lover or even somebody who's sort of intrigued by Sondheim, you're going to really enjoy what we're about to do because there is a new book that came out just a while ago, and it's called How Sondheim Can Change Your Life. I saw that title and I went, get me that book. I want to read it. And we are joined this morning by the author, Richard Chook, who is in London, where he's lived for quite a long time, which means you get West End productions of Sondheim, of course. But hi, Richard, welcome. And you too, by the way, have found that Sondheim has changed your life. Tell us how it all started.
Well, Paul, first of all, thank you. It's great to be with you and your viewers and listeners, fellow Sondheim fans. You asked me how I got my start with Sondheim. I think I was 16 or 17. I was in high school, and somehow I landed on to listening the original cast album of Sweeney Todd, Angela Lansbury, Len Carew. And, you know, back in the days of vinyl, long play, two record original cast album. And I just listened to it and listened to it and listened to it and fell in love with it. And then my freshman year at Georgetown in D.C. coincided with the first national tour of Sweeney Todd with Angela Lansbury still playing Mrs. Lovett. And George Hearn was playing Sweeney Todd. And this is about 6 weeks into my freshman year at Georgetown. And I went to the Kennedy Center to see the national tour of Sweeney Todd, and it blew the roof off the theater and blew off the top of my head as well, because it was such a magnetic, charismatic, fearsome evening in the theater. And when your first Sondheim is serial murder and cannibalism, you're hooked. You're in for life. So it's been a love affair ever since Sweeney Todd.
And indeed, Sondheim has become, I mean, he was larger than life, I think, certainly in the last period of his life. He's clearly larger than life now as we look back on his work. But let's talk a little bit, because what you do in this book, you have a series of chapters. You walk through around 11 shows or so, basically each one having a message for us, or that you suggest is a message for us. I want to talk about at least some of those as we go through. But you also do a little teaching here beyond that. You yourself are a teacher, and I know you've taught classes in Sondheim, so lucky students on your end. But Sondheim himself, actually, because we think of what we can learn from Sondheim, Sondheim had to learn from somebody. And some people who don't know might be surprised who one of the true mentors in his life was, because it's a big name.
Oscar Hammerstein, the Oscar Hammerstein. So Sondheim grew up in Manhattan, but his parents divorced when he was still a child, maybe 12, 13. And he and his mother went to live in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. And, you know, under the category of there is a God, his next door neighbor, nearish, in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, was Oscar Hammerstein. And he struck up a friendship with Hammerstein's son, Jamie. They became pals. And Sondheim was already interested in the theater. And when he was 14, 15, he wrote an entire musical, script and lyrics. And he had, you know, the nerve, audacity, gall, and gumption to ask Oscar Hammerstein to read it. And he said, you know, give me a professional critique. And Hammerstein did. And he sat him down one weekend afternoon, and he said to 14-year-old Stevie Sondheim, you want my professional response? Well, this is the worst thing I have ever read. Poor 14-year-old Sondheim, thinking he had written the next Tony Award winner. And Hammerstein, being the great teacher and mentor that he was, went on and he said, now, if you want to know why it's so bad, I'll tell you. And he spent the next 4 hours going page by page through Sondheim's first show. And forever after, Sondheim said he learned more about musical theater in that one afternoon than most composers or librettists learn in a lifetime. And one of his cherished possessions was a photograph of Oscar Hammerstein, who died not long after Gypsy. And Hammerstein signed the photograph and it said to Stevie, my friend and teacher.
That's amazing.
Beautiful message. So Sondheim, of course, became himself a teacher, not just in his formal master classes, but of course through his works. And in a way, that's the leitmotif of the book. What can Sondheim teach us? What is the more that he can give us to see?
And you write in the book, and maybe it's from that story, that you make the comment that Sondheim never courted failure, but he wasn't ashamed of it either. He had some shows that did not do very well.
That's right. And he was, I think, talking with reference to Anyone Can Whistle, 1964, which ran for n nine performances on Broadway. One of the New York critics wrote in his scathing review, "Anyone can whistle, but nobody can sing." And Angela Lansbury was one of the leads in that show, which just goes to show you not always to listen to the critics. But that was a but Anyone Can Whistle, which is, sort of now a Sondheim cult classic. It's performed now and then. Its themes are very heavy. It's an attack on nuclear weapons, bourgeois conformity, McCarthyite red baiting, although its resonances sound very timely for our time. But that was really heavy going for a musical in 1964.
I think, again, pulling life lessons, because the life lessons aren't just, for me, in your book, aren't just in those shows that you point out. But another point you make around that same point in the book is you say, look, flops are okay, at least if you've done something that hasn't been tried before. And one of the things
Right.
I teach when I teach communication classes is there's no such thing as failure-only feedback. Sounds like a similar point.
That's exactly right. And he learned from the feedback he got from and Anyone Can Whistle, including from people like Peter Schaffer, who wrote went on to write Amadeus and Equus.
Yeah, you're right. Didn't they
And
meet? Weren't they on a plane or something?
they
And were
were
they?
they yes, they met they were on a plane when Schaffer kind of gave him this long interpretation of why Anyone Can Whistle didn't work. And basically it boiled down to don't make fun of your audience. And that was sort of the first lesson that he learned. But it's sort of, learning and making theater. I'm going to sound a bit professorish now, but learning and making theater are both kind of practice-based projects. They're both iterative practices. You offer work, you get feedback, a critique on it, and then you do it again and you get better. And that's all there is to it. It's very difficult, but that's the paradigm. That's the shape of how you improve as an artist or as a learner. You try, you get an appraisal of your work, and you try again, but you don't give up.
Various things with Sondheim. What's really fascinating is people would modify and change things. One of the shows you use and you write about, for example, is Company. Well, Company went through a major shift in his lifetime, right shortly before he died, where, of course, the main players in the show were, if you were a man, you became a woman, where there's a couple, they become it's a gay couple. And Sondheim was all for that. But I'm sort of curious, as you pull life lessons out from these, how important, how much do you tie the lesson to a certain interpretation of the show when it was presented in a particular period of time?
That's a terrific question. And the short answer is not at all, because there can be changes in casting. We have Audra as Madame Rose in Gypsy at the moment. You were referencing the gender swap revival of Company, which started first in London and then went to and then went to Broadway. We have
Yeah.
Merrily We Roll Along, which originally had 18-year-olds, and then the latest Broadway revival had 40-somethings in the roles. So there are
And
all
by the
kinds
way,
of things
flop in its old days, big hit in it when it came back.
turned to profit in 2023, 2024. So you can change all kinds of things on the stage, but what doesn't change are the music and the lyrics, and of course the libretto with sometimes many collaborators. And for me, that's the heart, the essence, the core of the material. So the themes of the work seem to me constant and enduring. The angle, take, perspective, slant that every new fresh production brings to it is wonderful, but the bedrock really is the material.
How often did you find, do you find, that Sondheim's teachings or even his writing really are a reflection of his own life experiences? And I have a particular example in mind. When you write about Into the Woods, you don't spend time on the song Children Will Listen. And yet, one of the things I found fascinating, assuming this is a true story, that Sondheim himself has told this story, was that when his mother was very ill or maybe on her deathbed or something, he was with her. They didn't get along very well. And she said, the greatest regret I have in life was having you. And you hear that story from him in his words, and then the actors go on to perform Children Will Listen. That brings me to tears every time I think about it. And so my question to you is, how often do we see Sondheim's life in his music and words like that time?
You know, Sondheim himself would have said, not at all. He always resisted the idea that his works were veiled autobiographies or were confessional in some way. But of course, with any artist, anybody working in the, creative fields, you're always bringing something of yourself, of your own perspective, your own fears, your own hopes, your own longings to your work. So undoubtedly, there's a connection. People write about what motivates them and what interests them and what obsesses them. But I would say I think that's as far as we can go. And to try and to sort of connect the dots between certain characters, certain songs, and certain very concrete events or relationships in Sondheim's life may not shed as much light as we think it will. And I also think that the risk in looking at shows as sort of prisms of Sondheim's life is that we end up not making room for us. Because ultimately, the shows are about our life, how the shows move us, strike us, trouble us, please us, dissatisfy us. So we have to make sure that our life is front and center as well when we encounter those works, and not just Sondheim's. I never met him. I never wrote him. Now I kind of wish I did because he always wrote back. But in a way, I'm glad that I had no personal connection with Sondheim because I could just set aside all of those biographical issues and focus on what for me is the pure gold, the music and the lyrics.
I did meet him once at Ravinia here in Chicago. They used to do a tribute to him every year. And one year, because I knew he would be there and I would see him, I had a prop from the show Bounce, which was a horrible failure here. And it took many forms after that. But it started here at the Goodman. And so when I ran into him and talked to him, he saw I had something in my hand. He goes, I don't sign anything, or I don't want to sign anything. And I said, well, Stephen, let me tell you what this is. And I told him that this was a prop from that stage, from the stage, which had flown into my lap during a scene from Richard Kind's hand. And he smiled and he went, "That I'll sign." So a little humanity in his being, and was certainly very gracious at the moment. So, Richard, it's time to look at the various chapters where you pick a show, oftentimes a song in that show, and say, "This can change your life." One of Sondheim's absolute classics, of course. Well, actually, West Side Story is a classic, but you don't use West Side Story. We should very briefly explain, why did you skip West Side Story?
I skipped West Side Story because Sondheim never really liked his lyrics. Leonard Bernstein wrote the music. Sondheim did just the lyrics. But he didn't think much of his own lyrics, so I took my cues from Sondheim himself.
Fair enough. We go to Gypsy, which many have called the most perfect musical in terms of the way it's written. But one of the things you say is, the story itself in a sentence is about a parent's obsession with their own unfinished business. And that, of
Right.
course, is Mama Rose in the show as we look through it. But talk about the message we take out of it, because what I find is you make this comment that you have to be who you are, and there's no sentimentalist in the show of Gypsy.
That's right. And of course, Sondheim for Gypsy wrote just the lyrics. Julie Stein did the music. And Mama Rose, Madame Rose gets all the love when we talk about Gypsy. But in my chapter, I actually put the spotlight on Louise, because she is the quote unquote untalented one, but who turns out to be the most talented of all. She's unloved in a way, neglected by her mother. And it is a perfect musical because we see Louise go through all of these costumes. She plays a newsboy, a soldier, a farm boy. She's the back end of a cow costume, but she's never herself on stage until she becomes the stripper, Gypsy Rose Lee. So her journey really is about shedding all disguises and roles and impostures that her mother has put upon her, stripping them away, if you will, to finally become the beautiful woman, star of the stage, divinity of the theater, Gypsy Rose Lee, that she truly is. And I think there's a lesson for everybody in there, which is whether it's your parents or society, someone is going to try and slap a label on you. Someone is going to try and put you in the corner and cast you in a role, and don't let them do it. You have to be who you are and take Gypsy Rose Lee as your role model.
This book is also filled with little great stories, and there's one in which maybe Gypsy Rose Lee received a telegram from Eleanor Roosevelt, right? That says something fairly interesting. If people are going, what? Go get the book, which is coming out in paperback on November 11th, by the way, and you'll read what Eleanor Roosevelt, and it's a shocking, stunning thing to read if it actually happened. And I'll just ask you this. Do you think it happened? Do you think she actually sent that telegram?
I like to think that she sent it. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Do it. So we talked about company a little bit and the gender changes and those sorts of things, but you do say, here's the thing. Well, company, if you would go to it, looks like it's kind of all about marriage. And you say, really, it's about intimacy. And in that respect, there's a lot of messages for different people, gay men, or lesbians. I mean, anybody, there's different lifestyles. I mean, there's messages for everybody when you go see company. It's about accepting yourself and the notion of intimacy.
Right. Now, in 1970, there was only one kind of marriage in the United States, heterosexual marriage, and company had a heterosexual director, Hal Prince, the librettist George Firth, and Sondheim, two gay men in the Stonewall era. They weren't particularly interested in the sociology of marriage. And in fact, Sondheim had to ask his best friend, Mary Rogers, daughter of Richard Rogers, tell me what it's like being married. So the show uses marriage because it's what people know. It's just a very convenient shorthand. But really, it's about intimacy, commitment, making yourself emotionally vulnerable. What happens when you do that? And even more importantly, what happens when you don't do that? Which is why, as you say, the show is for everybody. LGBTQIA plus our heterosexual allies, and that's why the gender swap version works. So to limit company to marriage is kind of doing it a disservice, though in 1970, that was the only way to do it.
And probably why Sondheim liked the idea of that shift many years later, in the 2020s or so when it happened. Follies, I got to do that show back in the community theater years ago. But interestingly enough, you talk about two things I pull out of that. Number one, you talk about the show itself as sort of like surviving your past, and so much of it is a look at past by these four sort of aging characters. But at the same time, you make this point in that show, and probably true of several of his shows, there's no sort of linear plot that walks us through Follies. We just have to take the message from it.
That's right. And this idea, some people call it the concept musical. I'm not a big fan of that phrase. Just think of it as a musical without a traditional story. But Company doesn't have much of a traditional story either. But it does have a lot of action. And with Sondheim, the action is always internal. He used the word subtext. It's the inner turmoil that the characters are going through. So yes, what happens in Follies? Well, people show up at a reunion, they have some drinks, they do some old tap routines, they fight, they deal with some of their illusions, and they break out into this crazy, surreal Follies number, and then they leave the theater at dawn. So, but a lot is happening inside. So with Sondheim, the drama is always inside the character, even if on the surface things seem polite or calm, not chaotic. But Follies is about looking back at your past, and as Ben says, the road you didn't take, and sometimes revisiting that road you didn't take, and wondering what your life would have been had you taken that better road.
And the message seems to be, and take that road, which I find interesting as you shift into Little Night Music, because there's an interesting sort of next step from the road you took or didn't take. And the message from Little Night Music, among others, where you say it's kind of about handling regret.
Exactly. And this is the classic song, Send in the Clowns.
Yeah.
And I am going to die on the hill that Send in the Clowns is not a lush, sentimental, romantic ballad. It is not a love song. It is not a torch song, which is a love song of unrequited love. It is, as Sondheim said, a song of anger and regret. It is a dark song. It's sung by Desiree, who has taken a great emotional risk by saying to Friedrich, her ex-lover, look, we're middle-aged, let's just settle down and, get some coherence in our life. And Friedrich says, no, I'm going to go back to my 19-year-old virgin bride and try and renew my unrenewable youth, as he says. And then he walks out on her, and she's left there emotionally devastated. She risked everything, and she lost. And that's what the song is about. You know, it's been recorded more than 400 times, including by some wonderful singers, but it is not a pleasing love song.
In fact, you write that Sondheim himself said, this is a song that ought to be done in piano bars in Greenwich Village.
He famously never liked his own songs, and he didn't like Sending the Clowns. Exactly. He said, yeah, it should be done in a piano bar. And of course it is. But, you know, people like Glynis Johns and Judi Dench know that it is a tragic song.
Is it still misunderstood today when people perform it, or given what you've written, what you've said, do people say, now when they perform it, now they kind of get it? The people who do Sondheim tributes, Liz Callaway recently here in Chicago doing a Sondheim tribute, did that song.
Oh, the divine Liz Callaway. I got a chance to meet her at Crazy Cocks in London a few months ago. And I know she say she was on your show recently from Chicago, a great Sondheim chanteuse. I think in the theater, people understand how the song works. It's in concerts and cabarets and certain kinds of pop recordings where the temptation is for the singer to flatter their voice rather than to honor or serve the song. But I think in the theater, you're in safe hands. This is why sometimes songs can be very difficult to do outside of the productions themselves, because they depend so much upon the character and the story and the predicament.
There are so many shows to talk about. Can you stay with me? And after the show, we'll continue to talk about some of these in a bonus track that we'll do on WGNradio.com. But let's wrap this one up with this final point, because you say in the book, Sondheim doesn't let us hide from the truth, from our truth.
That's right. From the truth of the characters, which is a mirror of our truth. And I wrote that with respect to the musical passion, which really divided audiences. Even a lot of Sondheim fans don't like passion, and based upon a 19th century novel. And one of the reasons is that all the things we've come to expect of musical theater, including Sondheim, which is witty lyrics, charming characters, happy endings, easy resolutions, you don't get in passion. What you get is, you know, a megawatt spotlight on suffering. And the suffering is almost always about being in love with someone who doesn't love you.
Very powerful. The book is How Sondheim Can Change Your Life by Richard Shook. Available in hardcover now, available in paperback on November 11th. If you're watching or listening to us on WGNradio.com, stay with us, because we're going to keep talking about more Sondheim shows. And for those here on WGN Plus, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week on Behind the Curtain. All right, for those of you watching us here on WGNradio.com or YouTube or wherever else you watch and listen to your podcast, I'm continuing my conversation with Richard Shook, the author of How Sondheim Can Change Your Life. And if you are a theater lover as we are, then I know you're still with us. And we're going to talk about a few more shows. You got to read the book to get all that there is to get from the book, but we are whetting your appetite a little bit. So, Richard, you've covered so many shows, Pacific Overture, some we're not going to talk about, but we talked about Sweeney Todd before, but let's talk about it in terms of its message. And that is, you say, and it's such a, I mean, who would write a show about a murderer and meat pies and everything else that they do? But you say, really, the show is about how not to deal with injustice.
That's right. And, you know, there's nothing but injustice in the world of Sweeney Todd. And there's injustice at the individual level. People like Judge Turpin, who, of course, you know, had Sweeney arrested on trumped up charges and sent to a penal colony in Australia from which he escaped, and then, raped Sweeney's wife, a trauma from which she never recovered, and drove her insane, and then took Sweeney's daughter into his own home and intends to marry her, though she's, but a child, 16, 17 years old. And then there's the injustice of the macro level social order, the system, if you will, that keeps the downtrodden down. The class hierarchies in Sweeney Todd are everywhere in that production. And towards the end of the show, Anthony cries, Anthony the sailor who saves Sweeney at sea, cries, "Is there no justice in this city?" And I thought that's really this theme. It's, revenge is sort of in there. Revenge is a response to injustice. And, Sweeney has moral righteousness on his side at the beginning of Sweeney Todd, when he aims to kill Judge Turpin, who is responsible for all these horrific events in his and his family's life. He has moral righteousness on his side. But when he has that song where he says, "I'm just going to indiscriminately kill everybody, not one man nor 10 men nor 100 can assuage me," then it's gone too far. And this is so Sweeney comes up with the wrong response to injustice. He thinks he can just sort of slash and kill his way to a morally better world. But what happens, of course, is that he turns into the mirror image of the very evil that he is trying to eradicate in the world. And that seems to me the deeper lesson, that Sweeney Todd is really asking us to think about how are we going to confront all the manifold injustices that are in our own world, which is why I think sometimes works are never going to be irrelevant, are never going to go out of date, because there are always live issues at stake in his works, and injustice, sadly for us, is one of them today.
And that message can get lost because there's such drama. I think that show is so, engrossing in so many different ways that I don't know, the people walk out, they're talking about a lot of things, like falling off a barber chair, but whether or not they remember, no, I'm glad we talk about that message here. Merrily We Roll Along, we mentioned earlier as well, a flop in 1981, which, with 16 performances, which means it's on the wall of Joe Allen's pub, right, or wherever they put up the big flops in New York. But it comes back with Daniel Radcliffe, and it's a huge hit. So my question there, and by the way, you write that Sondheim, back at that time when Merrily closed, made the comment, "I don't want to be in this profession anymore. It's too hostile and mean-spirited." Was it the star power of a Daniel Radcliffe and a Jonathan Groff that made it work? What made it work when it comes back decades later?
That's such a good question. The libretto by George Firth and Sondheim's score were worked on over the intervening years. And by about the year 2000, the show had been reshaped to the point that we see it today. There's not time to go into all the details, but part of it was just the structure of the show and the arrangement of the numbers and giving characters songs that they needed to make their own arc clearer in the story. So the show itself needed some rehabilitation. Also, and this will sound like a small thing, but it's not, you have to have adults in those roles, right? We learned from 1981 that you cannot have a cast of 18-year-olds playing 40-year-olds, but you can do it the other way around. The audience will accept it. Now, of course, it didn't hurt that Daniel Radcliffe and Jonathan Groff and Lindsay Mendez, stars of theater and film in their own right, were in the cast. But I think the choices that really made the show succeed were the structural changes and having an adult cast. And also, not to be underestimated, Maria Friedman's direction. And her direction began in London a decade earlier when she did Merrily We Roll Along. The New York version is sort of the reprise. She really saw it as Frank's story. It's a story of one person, not three people. And that just kind of made the show click into place. But, it's a funny thing. The stars have to align. But when they do align, it suddenly feels like you have a whole new show on your hands.
And yet you say the message is always the same. We're not going to let the direction or the stars make a difference in it. Sunday in the Park with George, probably one of his most famous shows. To me, that's always been two plays in one. Act two, so different from act one. But essentially, people would look, and if you were looking for your own message out of the show, you might say, well, it's how to be an artist. And because you have lines in the show like design, tension, composition, balance, light, harmony. It sounds very artistic, but you say, actually, we all have an artist within us. And so the message about art, I think, is strong. And of course, you use as one of the songs to make your point, Finishing the Hat, which is such a great song.
It is. And I think if we look at Sunday in the Park with George, which is about, in the first act, the painter George Seurat, a historical character. In the second act, his fictional great grandson, George, who's a multimedia sculptor, we would think, oh, this is kind of inside baseball about people, who work formally as artists in museums or art galleries. But that seems to me the premise, the takeaway or the message or the value of the show is that we can all be artists in our own way, not in the formal sense, but I think, in the existential sense of doing what an artist does, which is paying attention and noticing and focusing and being present and being mindful. And that's how the show opens. And Dot is kind of like all of us. She's got these heavy clothes, it's glaring sun. She's trying to stand still while George sketches her in the park, and she's finding it very difficult to pay attention and to be still and to be present in the moment. But that is the task or the gift of an artist. And I think that invitation to be thoughtful and to notice and to be present, that invitation is open to everyone at all times. And that's such a beautiful message from Sunday in the Park with George. And of course, it's why Marie, the grandmother in Act Two, gets this beautiful song, Children in Art.
And why Sondheim let Streisand change some of the words to one of the songs, we'll never know, but he did. So she could record The Art of Making Art. Into the Woods, you write about that. You say it's about choosing the right path. Of course, that recently on a national tour with the beloved Gavin Creel, who also was one of the stars of that show and passed away. And one of my favorite players, Kennedy Kanagawa, who played a fabulous Milky White in that show. I recently interviewed him and his fiance, David Gao, on the show. But that being said, you concentrate on the baker's wife. Why the baker's wife when I could take you in a lot of different directions in that show for a message, including the witch and the song Children Will Listen?
Absolutely. There are just 100 ways into that show, and it's probably Sondheim's most popular show. But there was just something about her song "Moments in the Woods," which she sings not long before she dies. I think all of your listeners and viewers will know that sadly she dies in the
They
show,
know
but
now.
they know now. Though comes back as a ghost, as a spirit, at the end. There was something about her dilemma, particularly after she has her assignation with the Prince Charming in the woods. And I thought this is the story of stories. This is the core essential story. When you finally meet Prince Charming, and of course, Prince Charming is not meant to be understood literally, but when you finally meet a Prince Charming and you kiss Prince Charming, you then need to decide what's next. And everything hangs in the balance. And I really wanted to explore that. And one of the reasons, and here's a fair few readers have contacted me and say that they do not agree at all with the perspective I take on the song Moments in the Woods. One of the things I do in the chapter is I offer two contradictory readings, interpretations of her song. One is that going back home to the baker is a good choice after she kisses the prince. And the other is that going back home to the baker is a tragic choice, the absolute worst choice, which is why she dies a few minutes later. But I just thought, however we look at it, a good choice or a bad choice, this is the most decisive moment for a character in Into the Woods.
And again, we're going to let people read the book to read many more plays. I do want to talk about Assassins for a moment, if I may, because just as Sweeney Todd would have you go, why would anybody write a story with this stuff? And which was kind of an opera, actually, as it began. But Assassins, the concept of let's talk about presidential assassins or would-be assassins, and let's write about them. And you talk about the fact it's really not about the politics of doing it all, which somebody like me who covers politics and whatever, the first time I saw it many years ago, that's what it was for me. And it wasn't about that. And you talk about the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald gets an 11-minute scene. But the point is, things, the expectations people have about that show and the motivations, it's just not what it's about.
That's right. It's a very edgy show. And it's one of those shows that I think fares better critically over here in the United Kingdom than it does in the United States. And I think it's just that difference we have over here, being distanced from American politics, that it's just a bit easier for Brits to sort of see underneath what the very profound social critique that is going on. And it seems to me that Assassins isn't about, as you say, political parties or ideological struggles. It's not about gun control. Some people think it's about that. And the message is certainly not, oh, there's an assassin lurking inside all of us. I think it's trying to get us to say, look, these people were villains. What they did is sinister and evil and morally repugnant. But why? They thought they were doing something right. They thought they were doing something necessary. They were bringing a better America forward. How could that be? How could someone get themselves into the position where they think that the right thing to do? Charlie Guiteau, who assassinated President Garfield, supported Garfield's election. So it seems to me that the message of Assassins is not there's an assassin lurking inside everybody. I think that's a very facile message. The message seems to be there are assassins in our midst, and we just don't care how that came to be. We don't care that there are whole populations of people who feel marginalized, excluded, pushed aside, unwanted. And that gives rise to the social turmoil that in a very few exceptional cases leads to violence. But the violence comes from a widespread feeling of feeling excluded in your own country.
You write about the show Passions. I'm going to skip that one here. I know you relate strongly to that show, but I'm going to let people read that. I do want to, as I wrap with you in a moment, talk about Sondheim's last work, Unfinished, were unfinished by him anyway, called Here We Are, because you saw it. I did not see it. I am jealous. I hope it will come back. It had a short run on Broadway. I don't know what the plans for it are, but you sort of looked at that, and there's a lot of meaning in that show for you now that we know it's Sondheim's final work.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to see it in New York at the Shed, where it ran for a few months, late 23, early 24. And then I saw it just a month or so ago here in London at the National Theatre. So I can say I've had the privilege of seeing the London and New York premieres. And it is famously not finished. I'm going to sound a bit professorish, but I prefer the term not finished to unfinished. Unfinished sounds like, oh, there was a problem, he died, and there should have been more songs and all that sort of thing. Not finished is, you know, you put down your tools. We're just going to stop. And that's what Sondheim did. He said, I'm going to stop. I'm not going to finish this work. So one of the ways I describe it is I say the work is final. This is it. There would be no more tinkering, no more tinkering. Here we are. It is final, but it is not finished. It is not finished by choice, on purpose, by design. The very nature of the work is that it's not finished. So when I went to see the show, I thought this is such a beautiful metaphor for life. Our life is final because we don't get to go back in time and repeat it, but also our life is not finished because there are all sorts of things that we'll never get to do. So for me, Here We Are is such this beautiful gift that Sondheim gave us. He was 89 when he was working on it. And this sort of beautiful meditation, I think, on the nature of life itself. Final, but not finished.
You write a lot about that, about a silent grand piano that sits in the middle of the room, and I guess not much music in the second act at all. But again, it's brilliant what you just say, which is it's not like he didn't get to it. If Sondheim was here, he'd go, "That's it. That's what I want."
Exactly.
The book is brilliant, even if you don't take your own life lessons out of it. But there's so much that you can take out of it, and what a great idea for a book! How Sondheim can change your life. Volume two should be Stephen Schwartz. Just write a whole thing about Wicked and Pippin. We'll be fine in your next volume, Richard Shook. Congratulations! What a great book! Again, it's out in hardcover, and I must say, hardcover, but also sort of like an easy to hold hardcover. It's not one of those huge, humongous things. You can bring it on a plane, and it comes out in paperback on November 11th. Congratulations on this! As I said, I don't remember how I came across. Across it, but when I did, I tracked you down and said, I just really want to talk about this. So, thank you so much for the Sondheim fans who I know are watching us. I think they would send a thank you to as well. I hope they all pick up a copy of the book because we just kind of touched the surface of all the great details and great stories that are in it. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Paul. It's been great talking with you.
And thanks to all of you for watching and listening us here on Behind the Curtain. We will see you next week.